How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
We have the honor today of being joined by one of the all-time great researchers, Dr. John Newman. Dr. Newman is a retired U.S. Army major with a background in strategic intelligence as a cryptologic analyst, among many other roles that he held. From 1988 until 1990, Dr. Newman was the military assistant to the director of the National Security Agency. He retired from the military in 1994, and right now, Dr. Newman is currently an adjunct professor of political science at James Madison University. He has written 5 books that are on the topic of the assassination of President Kennedy, as well as books on other topics. And long story short, Dr. Newman knows his stuff, and we're excited to hear from him today about his perspective on Oswald and Mexico City, among other topics. So thank you, Dr. Newman, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me. It's good.
Good stuff.
Good.
Well, we'll kind of just get right into it on Mexico City. So one of the big questions that people have is whether Oswald really went to Mexico City at all. And the reason for that is there's all these sightings in Texas, in particular the Sylvia Odio sighting, which we're not going to go in depth on. But your perspective on whether or not Oswald physically went to Mexico City, you do believe that he went, right?
Yes, for a lot of reasons, because when you put all the pieces together, it's him. That's Oswald, all right. You know, he doesn't know, not the whole time through in New Orleans or anything. He still loves like the show he loves so much, I Led Three Lives. He's just jazzed up, thinking this is really hot stuff, you know, and working two sides, you know, as he did in New Orleans. So he's very happy to play this role again. And it's a completely different role than it was back in 1959, for example. Okay, so it's different. So Oswald is down there in order to get his stamps for who he is, what his legend's going to be when the shots ring out in Dealey Plaza. That's the most important part of the Mexico City story. Now, he'd done a lot already in New Orleans, and even before that part of 63, including parts of 1962. Anyway, by this point, he's got the Castro thing down pat. But what he's missing now is the other part of it, which is the KGB. Now, he was, of course, in the Soviet Union, but it was a long time beforehand. So this is a trip that where he's gonna knock both of those things off. And with a story that is totally not true, which is that he was going to go back to the Soviet Union again, defect another time via Cuba, which his papers that he had after he went over to the Soviet Union before were still authorized him to go to the Soviet Union the same way he did through Helsinki. But on those papers, it told him that you can't go through Cuba. So what is he doing? He's down there saying, I'm going through Cuba to defect again, and I'll meet my wife over there, and so on and so forth. So that's just the shell that is funny, but it really is not taking us where we need to go, which is exactly how do they, we're going to do this. There was a lot of pieces in this puzzle in order that he, a two-time commie defector, on his way back again, you know, is going to be in, allegedly, in on this, what it was, a sixth floor or seventh floor.
Sixth, yeah.
On the parade route with all those things. I mean, you can't, it doesn't get any more dangerous than that, you know?
Right.
And yet he's going to be able to do that. He's going to be able to be up there and nobody is going to worry about it because they've suppressed his threat profile in both the CIA and, more importantly, the FBI, because they're the ones responsible for the parade route.
Right. And just to tie a bow on the sightings in Texas and the Sylvia Odio story, your perspective on that is that maybe it's just smoke and mirrors, because it does seem, you know, the guy said all these things that made it seem like he was trying to reference Oswald. But maybe there could just be different spy games going on, or how would you categorize that?
Well, how about Dealey Plaza? People, and now my good friend Jamie Galbraith just wrote something last year, and saying that as far as he's concerned, the whole Dealey Plaza thing is just a big shit show to fool everybody into believing this or that, and they've been doing that ever since. We've got all these small groups with one leader in it, and they don't like each other very much. So we can't really call it the JFK research community. It's not really much of a community. It's just people arguing and throwing stuff at each other, you know? And I like to say it's like a clue game, you know? One person says it's Colonel Mustard with the wrench in the, you know, in the kitchen, and then the next guy's got another one, and they don't want to hear anything else but that. So it's about the same thing when you talk about, about Mexico City. And why is that so? Because you, the best thing you can do if you're doing this clandestine thing and you've got a lot of pieces and you're talking about killing the president of the United States, this is not some little thing. It takes a lot of preparation to do that. And one of the things that is in that preparation is complete, opaqueness. Okay, that's right. Really what's going on here. And so nobody really knows, except for Danny Hardwood. Dan Hardwood's a good friend of mine, but he's now quit. He's up in West Virginia. And anyway, and Lopez, Eddie Lopez, those two guys did a classified study. And it wasn't declassified for a long time on Oswald in Mexico City. Mm-hmm. Now, I was doing it myself, by myself, in Oswald and the CIA. It's part of that book. And the hardest part was for me to figure out what was going on in Mexico City, because it didn't make any sense. And so, you know, I came down to the, and I was actually, this book was with Carolyn Graff, and that's a small company, but anyway, it was for them, and I was getting close to the deadline, and so I had to make up my mind what the hell went on down there, and finally it just was like a light bulb went off. Of course he was there, and of course the imposter was there, and that was the whole problem, that they got where everything went off track, because it was a really nice plan, but you know, sometimes plans don't work the way they're supposed to. So when he got down there and tried to get this visa to get into Cuba, it didn't work.
Yeah. So
now that's why the other guy is there, because Oswald is talking to these people and saying things inside the Cuban consulate and inside the Soviet embassy. And it takes 2 days what he does on that. And then after that, he pushes the papers away, because they tell him you're going to have to 4 months. You got to wait 4 months. We're going to send these stuff up. And he just pushes the papers away. Actually, it's intriguing, but puts a revolver on the table and cries and says, see what I got to do with the FBI and all that kind of stuff. But that's just, so that's the end about, and the consulate, the embassy was closed. But how Saturday, we got in there was because they were there for a volleyball game. And so by the time Kostikov walked in, he was still sitting. He was sitting there with Yachkov, right? And so they and so they do all this stuff, and then he gives up, and that's the last time he says anything. Now there might be something on Monday that Phillips said something about that's, but that's. Let's just leave that alone because it's just it may not have happened. It might have, but the point is that's when what we say you know the what happened after that point was like the movies. You know, it was nothing was real about it. They had a guy who had to pretend he was Oswald, and they had to do it fast because time had run out, and so. And the last thing was that was going to happen was he didn't talk to Oswald and Oswald didn't talk to him. So what he does is try and figure out what was going on. And one of the things that was going on was this idea that he about the paperwork going up there. And so the guy on later in Saturday and then after that as well says, I'm checking to see if my papers have come back from Washington. But they were never sent.
Right.
Because Oswald wasn't doing
no papers.
So Oswald was not in there. And he didn't know what would have been said inside there. So you have two complete different characters in two different scenes. And they're not crossing each other. It's what happens is they go from one to the other because it didn't work. He didn't get the visa. And that's why it happened. That's what happened down there. And that's how you put it all together.
So a quick question on languages that were used. So there's this phone call that, you know, supposedly the CIA says was Oswald, and it's in Spanish to the Soviet consulate. And then there's Oswald speaking English to the Cuban consulate, even though, you know, Spanish is their native language. And then he speaks broken Russian to the Soviet consulate when he calls from the Cuban embassy.
Yeah,
so what do you make of that?
What is the one that was going on? Broken Russian.
You think broken Russian was the actual Oswald?
Yeah, because and we know that he studied it. Now, he spent a lot of time studying it before he went to Moscow. In fact, that's one of the times when we know what it's up because he hasn't come back yet, but he knows that because he was at Atsugi. I don't want to spend too much time on that whole thing, but that's when we knew. And so he was studying, and it was possible that he was at Defense Language Institute in Monterey where I did my, but it doesn't matter where he was there or had somebody else tutoring, but it was a long time. It was several years. So he wasn't studying his Russian until at the last minute. So he didn't really study it. He was using what he remembered that he had learned 4 years or 3 years ago. Right? 'Cause
he didn't speak much Russian at all when he was in the Soviet Union, right? He like his Russian, everyone said he had poor Russian. It was my recollection.
Yeah, but at least, you know, here's what he had. He had to say certain things. He had to say certain things in English to our guys in our consulate there. But he also, before he got to do that, had to talk to a bunch of Russians, all of whom were these KGB guys pretending to be somebody else. Mm-hmm. So he did speak a little bit of Russian. And what it would be a particular sentences that he had practiced saying. So it wasn't that he was fluent. Sure. He knew he was prepared and he was being prepared for and knew he was being prepared for that trip. So this is why by the time we're here, they say it's broken Russian. So it's pretty what we call FUBAR in the military. You know what that stands for, don't you?
Yes. Beyond all recognition.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So just quickly, The CIA had cameras pointed at the embassy, and you know, we have the real Oswald, then we have an imposter who's doing the things that Oswald was supposed to do and didn't finish doing. It seems like if the CIA should have captured the authentic Oswald in some of those images. I know we haven't talked about this
right. So why do you think that they wouldn't And then so allegedly, the cameras weren't working just for those couple of days. Now, why would the cameras not be working just for those couple of days? Answer, because Oswald was there and you don't want to show. You don't want to, you know, that is especially what was taking place there was not what was supposed to happen. So I just think, and it might have been that there were stuff. And you know, there we have a story from Wayne Scott that he had some pictures in his, and I'm aware of all that stuff in his safe. And they've all gone because James Jesus Angleton snuck down there after as soon as he died and took them. And that was the end. That's the story anyway, if you want to believe that. I don't know.
Related, have you, and again, this is something that we, this is the last thing I'm going to hit you with. We haven't already talked about, but Jefferson Morley came out with a story yesterday that has some overlap on this topic that, you know, this a CIA insider saw what looked like a, you know, VHS tape that said Oswald in Mexico in 1963. Do you have any comments or thoughts on that?
I don't, because I'm aware that it's come out, but I haven't really looked at it. I learned a long time ago that for me to actually take something seriously, I need independent sources that give me the same answer. So when something's new like that, I just nod my head. Okay, you know, I got that on my calendar. Look at it later. But yeah, you know, I don't know, Jeff. We know each other.
Right.
A long time.
Right.
The Jane Roman thing together.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And we'll get to that here in just a second. Do you recall if the Soviet officials, I couldn't find a comment in Nechi Parenko's book. Do you recall if they said that the guy they saw looked like Oswald from TV, or if they commented on that one way or the other?
We don't know. And the reason why I say that, because it should be either it's there or it's not. But what we've discovered is that pieces of that book are missing.
Okay.
That we know.
Interesting.
And I know Nechi Parenko because I was at a function where he came, and then there was a Russian woman who was definitely, and she was, you know, trying to be cool, you know, nice to American males. So they were there doing some stuff. It was in the United States. I remember that. I remember that's where I actually met him. And I think that most of the book is good, but some of the book, because of the fact that there's stuff missing, you know, I don't really know if I trust that somebody hasn't done stuff. Like, it's, remember, there's the Oswald's his personal history. Mm-hmm. It turns out it's not all his stuff. Somebody they managed to put things in there, and so I don't know whether everything in the Nechi Parenko book is, but it was a huge book in a lot of work, because after, and it was published after the fall of the USSR. And for a little while there, until the guys like Putin got back in, he was always espionage, by the way, and deception. But we had that short period of cooperation. And, you know, that's when ABC News got to sit down and take a look at something that we thought, a lot of people thought, including one of the investigators, the HSCA, thought couldn't have happened, and they took that side, and then they got embarrassed because ABC News found the document that was snitched out and not put back in before Oswald came back home.
Let's talk quickly here, because I know this is a whole story, but your book, Uncovering Popov's Mole, that is related a little bit to what we're talking about here. And when you and I had talked earlier, I remember you said, you haven't read Uncovering Popov's Mole? And I said, oh, I was going to get to the, you know, the the Soviet Union, who did it stuff, you know, next season. And you're like, oh, what are you doing? You're missing out. So then I got the book, read it, and sure enough, my mind was blown. And
you got a couple pieces missing too, because you got to go, you know, if you want to do the whole Bay of Pigs thing and everything else that they had on the table, you have to look at Countdown to Darkness. And Into the Storm also has a chapter that nobody remembers. And it's the reason, the only reason Kennedy got elected was because of Martin Luther King. Hmm. And it's a hell of a story to read that. So you might want to grab a hold of that and take a look at it, because I'm writing two books on him, but I keep pushing him downstream like I do my Armageddon thing because of the spy services stuff.
Right. I'm going to get the whole catalog. So okay. We'll be good. All right. So Uncovering Popov's Mole, I'm just going to give a super high level summary relevant to what we're talking about. And this is the conversation about how did Oswald go to the Soviet Union? There's a big debate. You know, folks that believe the official story say, you know, he's a genuine Marxist. He was interested in their, you know, way of life, and he was disillusioned with American capitalism, so that's why he went to the Soviet Union. You know, and then the other side always says, hey,
what do they really know about him? I mean, they're saying that story, but have they studied everything when he was over there, before he went there, and then everything that happened to him there, and everything right. that happened when he came back? Probably not. They probably did not study.
I would say no. But so the idea is for you know, that he was a false defector. But, you know, there's all these facts that we covered on Solving JFK. We've got four or five episodes on Oswald and the Soviet Union. And it looked like, you know, it's a lot, you know, him coming through Helsinki, and it's the place where he had the shortest wait, and he's able to get back so
but
easily.
Only if they will give you that. In other words, just because you go there to Helsinki doesn't mean you're going to get a quickie. But that's where businessmen go. And of course they want business, and they don't want it through more ordinary channels. And so that's how Helsinki as a quickie. Now, if you understand what's going on, Moscow Center wants him. So it wasn't even a week. It's like, yeah, you know, and boom, right in the door. You know, so yeah. And, you know, did they want him, or did he want to go there?
Right. So, okay. High level here on Popov's Mole, and then you can take the ball and run. There's this mole in the CIA who's, you know, someone who's a KGB agent in the CIA, and the CIA has its own mole in the KGB, or a defector in place, who is Peter Popov. And Popov, before he gets found out by the KGB and executed, tells his handler that in the CIA that, hey, there's a mole at the top of the CIA, and you know, they know about the U-2 spy planes, and they're up pretty high because they know some really important stuff. So what comes to light in Uncovering Popov's Mole is that Oswald was used as bait by this guy, Bruce Soley, who was doing a mole hunt to try to use, you know, Oswald's knowledge of the U-2 to get the Soviets to bite. And the idea...
I use the term flypaper.
Flypaper, yes. Yes, that is the term. But the idea is that Oswald would say that, you know, he's defecting, he's going to come in and say he's going to share information about the U-2 with the Soviets, which he did. And then the Soviets would want to know, is this guy legit? They would then ask their mole at the CIA to find out about Oswald. And when the mole's asking around, they would out themselves as being the one, you know, being the mole, because they're asking about Oswald. But it turns out that Bruce Soley was the mole hunter himself. And so it was a false mole hunt.
Yes.
The mole hunter is the mole. And so he kind of sent Oswald over there to be part of a false mole hunt. And you have this backed up by Pete Bagley, who was intimately involved in
the situation. He got that from the Russians afterwards. So it's not like he made it up or was thinking, you know, about it. I mean, he had multiple different people talking to him about it after it was all over.
Yeah. So did I accurately state the big picture? So he goes over there and of course nothing happens with the mole hunt. And by the way, Bruce Soley dies and he's still not discovered, right? Yeah. So you outed him. I mean, you made huge
70,
news.
71 years later, yeah.
Yeah, that was. I mean, that's really significant.
Well, I just happened onto it. It just happened onto it because I was doing Armageddon, and I've got some people that I work with that, you know, they check stuff and read it when and do that sort of thing, and so they started telling me, you know, John, there's something weird about this, and I knew there was something weird about it because there were things that just weren't making sense. And so we talked about it, and I gave in to my inner sanctum of folks. It's only three or four people that we needed to call that out as a separate book. And we did.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about who Pete Bagley was and your conversation with Bagley, where you got him to basically look at the documents and say, hey, you know, Oswald was
Malcolm
a winning
Blunt, by the way,
defector.
He showed him the documents, not me.
Oh, okay.
Malcolm told me the whole story.
Though. Malcolm Blunt.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Okay.
So Pete Bagley was counterintelligence, and he had been in Vienna a little bit, and as things moved, and he ended up eventually, not going to Berlin or a place like that, but he ended up in Bern, Switzerland. Which is where we had the CIA had stuff going on there. And so later when the Nosenko thing comes, the Nosenko provocation, Bagley's the guy that they go to instantly, they set it up. So that's in 62. So what you have to understand is that Bagley did not know anything about this particular part of the story of history, because he wasn't there. He was at another place. And so when Malcolm showed him, you know, all the pieces of paper, laid them all out, it was really, really obvious to him. He's got a mind like a steel trap. And he said, was he witting? And Malcolm doesn't know what to say. And he doesn't say anything. He said, come on, was he witting? And then he says, okay, no. No, no, no. He has to be winning. You know, don't you understand? It was a hell of a story. Pete Bagley, before he died, there was a big deal that I guess I forget whether it was a Scandinavian country. No, it was Germany. Germany put together a big thing to have everybody come and talk. They invited some people that were Soviets and some that were Americans, you know, that were involved in working against each other. And so it was after the fall of the Soviet Union. So everybody thought that was a cool idea. It was about 4 or 5 years after the fall of the Soviet Union. So they were doing that. They set it up. And so Koshchak was the guy, Vladislav Koshchak was the guy that actually, after they got Edward Ellis Smith to go back and help out in Washington. This is the U2 time period. But anyway, they went back. Three senior KGB guys left Moscow Center. Koshchak was the head, the KGB head against working against our embassy over there. And so they needed, Khrushchev went bananas because of the U2 thing. And when he found out in 58, which is when the Kiesewetter mentioned it on his way out, because he knew he was going to get executed, that's when he said, okay, I don't give a shit. Whatever else is going on, I want to know about these tech details that our mole back there in Washington has. And so he made them go talk to him. You can't get on the phone and do that, and you can't do it. You know, with look, both sides can break crypt, so that you can't do that either. You got to go travel face to face, and so they got a three-person group, mm-hmm. got their under false names. They got their visas at different times. They got on the planes at different planes, and they all met up back in Washington D.C. And they sat down with Sully and talked with him, but they had to do it in safe houses. And that was a big problem. That's why the one guy in Moscow that we had, who was a CIA guy, one man CIA thing, the Ellis Smith. You know, they used the sex trap to get him, and they told him what a great life he was going to have, and he did. I mean, they gave him a ton of money, and he went out to San Francisco and lived there for a long time till a car ran him over in about 19, I forget exactly where it was, but that's all they wanted from him. They wanted him to go over because three Russian guys walking around the streets of Washington, D.C. looking for safe houses look like three KGB guys looking for. So they needed an American to do it. And they needed him to be thrown out of the CIA. And McCord is the one doing the whole thing. McCord got over there, brought him back. McCord did the, you know, the inquest. And all the time telling him, don't worry, I'm going to be giving you money every week. And we're going to do all this stuff. And so, yeah, that's when they went back. Now, fast forward. This is where the interesting piece comes in, because so at this place where all these people from both sides come. And so it's the first morning. They haven't started the meeting yet. That's the first day of the meeting. And Bagley goes into the breakfast room, and sitting right there is Koshchak. And he knows who Koshchak is. And they know who each other is. They've been working against each other. They're both really smart. And they're not jerks either. I mean, it's very interesting stuff. And they eventually got along pretty well. But right there, he goes up to him and says, look, why ever did Koshchak make that trip to Washington? And so, you know, Koshchak sits there for a minute and he doesn't say anything. And he says, well, he said to meet an agent. And he's quiet and says, who never got uncovered. And then Bagley is thinking, oh, so many questions I want to ask him. No, I can't do that because I might ruin it. You know, so he didn't say anything else after that. It's a hell of a story, because Malcolm put those pieces of paper in front of him piece by piece. And so he knew a lot about it, but he just wanted to know more of what, you know, what he was going to say, confronted. And so that's what Malcolm thought. And that's what he thought too. But to have Koshchak tell him that is the bingo. Okay. When you get it from the mouth of the guy who was doing the whole thing, he was the one who had to, Khrushchev made him organize this whole thing to get back there. That's the first time that, we had somebody go find Sully to talk to. Now, they don't go to a safe house that he does, because that's an American safe house. They got to have different ones, and they use the movie theaters, a lot of them.
So turning back to Mexico City, all right, so Oswald goes to the Soviet Union, and really he's sent there on this mission for Bruce Sully, this false mole hunt. So in other words, Oswald going to the Soviet Union is not about sheep dipping him for the Kennedy assassination. It has nothing to do with that at all at that point.
Not even in the story.
59, right? I mean, it's not even, Kennedy's not even president yet. So
let me just say one thing real quick. Bruce Sully needs a way to deflect it from being him, because he was the one who was behind a lot of this stuff, including Popoff. They had to go find, in fact, after this group went over there in January of 57 for the meeting, then for the first time, Sully goes on a trip, clandestine, and actually the first place he goes is Beirut, and I did not know why for a long time, and that was to meet Philby to take over the daddy guy for Angleton, okay? But So Sully knows there has to be a mole hunt. By 1958, he knows, because the CIA now knows. So he knows there has to be a mole hunt, and he's still got plenty of time. So that's why he decides to do it. And what he has the power to do is to actually have the Office of Mail Logistics and the Record Integration Division tells them, oh, there's going to be a lot of stuff coming in from the CIA, the State Department, and the Navy. And when they do, nobody sees them except for me, goes to my desk.
And this is why. So that's also why Oswald's files didn't go to the Soviet Russia division. They went to this Office of Security. It wasn't. And to your point.
They were held aside for him to watch the whole thing happen. And it's even better than that, because Oswald had to say one or two sentences. And that's how we broke the Enigma thing in World War II with the Nazis, because we had somebody on the inside. And all it takes, you know, it's ones and twos and zeros and stuff like that. And if you have a the sentence, you can break the code. And so why do you think that Oswald had to go in there knowing that he wasn't going to go a second time, that they would tell him to go home and think about it? So he never did renounce his citizenship. He knew that was going to happen that way. So he goes in, speaks his lines, and guess what? Everything that all these other places are saying can be decrypted in Moscow, and Sully's sitting there and knows everything. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
it's a very interesting story. I've actually told you more than I knew in the book, but most of it, but I'm learning more stuff. And of course, there were bits and pieces of McCord in the book that I never tied them all together because I was so impressed with Sully.
Wow. Yeah. So more to come on that. Are you going to include the parts about McCord and Armageddon?
Well, yeah. So Armageddon's going to have to wait because I realize now that when it is the Cold War, basically the whole after World War II, that's what it was. So if you don't understand what the spy services are doing, you really are totally lost. And so, for example, here's the true story. All of the Western spy services were captured by 1951, and mostly earlier. 51 is just when the security office of the CIA was created. Now, that changes everything we thought we knew. I mean, everything. So now you've got every time something happens, and this is what's been slowing me down, I have to wait a second. They all know that, don't they? They know he said that. They knew he was going to do that. And it's just, unless you really put this piece in first, it's better than all the edges around the puzzle, but it's all the edges around the puzzle and a lot of stuff in between it, and you can just see where you got to go. That's what's really going on with this Sully guy. He was very smart. He was very quiet, and they thought because he was smart, it's not that much. He just knew if he opened his mouth one time and said the wrong thing, that it would be over for him. So where I'm going now, I have to push Armageddon back again, although it's getting bigger because I know a whole lot more now. So it's going to be a two-volume set. And the same thing after that with Martin Luther King. And right now I have a two-volume set I'm working on called Uncovering Moscow's Moles, because they're all over the place. That's why do you think I'm not drinking alcohol? I'm eating good food. And I'm out there hiking all the time because I'm 74, and it's going to take me till I'm 82 or 83 years old to finish this stuff. And I may not be, you know, I could lose my mind by then. I could, you know, have a pancreatic cancer by then. You never know what's going to happen. So, you know, that's the universe told me I'm supposed to do that stuff. And so I've stopped everything else, and that's what I'm doing. I've got books I've written that are fiction, you know, that are fun, and
yeah,
we're all gonna have to wait.
Well, we're grateful for you, you know, dedicating your life and so much quality research in this from the perspective of someone who's in a position to know. I mean, you really have a gravitas that there's not really anyone else, you know, I'm not trying to step on anyone's toes, but there's no one else that has your background that has the interest level and has dedicated the time on the research. So truly, it's been huge for you know, the body of knowledge overall.
I like it that you're saying that, because here's what's happened to me. When I wrote JFK in Vietnam, and then the Oswald and the CIA, everybody liked me. They thought, this is good stuff he's doing, you know? And then I keep following things, following the trail, you know, the gingerbread trail, whatever you want to call it, you know? And so I see, well, that's a mistake. That Angleton guy, he's such a pushover, you know? So all of a sudden, 5 books later, I'm not so, people don't like me so much anymore. Because, well, it contradicts something they have nowhere, or they don't want to be so far away from it. And you are, if you've only read, you know, Oswald and the CIA, you got a long road to travel to see where we're at. Mm-hmm. It's not just me, but it's mostly in my books. But Jamie Galbraith, Doug Horne, and a few other people are class acts, and they know exactly the same. They know what I know, but they haven't, you know, been there to write them. But they, you know, I know who they are, and they know who I am, and we have each other's backs, because they're constantly trying to stop us, ruining our computers, doing all kinds of stuff. There's nothing on my, I got a nice computer here. It's really great. It's a 32 gigabyte RAM, which is a beast, but there's nothing on the hard drive. Nothing at all.
You had someone from some agency steal your phone one time at a conference. Did I hear that?
Back afterwards. Yeah, it was down in Dallas, Texas. and we it was Apple, and so we got a hold of Apple, and there was something we could do, and they had a way of doing something, and it was in our building about 8 floors high, so they had snuck it out of my thing when I went into you know, they have places where there's books and stuff before. Lo and behold, I'm sitting there waiting for my second appearance. And everybody just comes out of the doors, you know, the previous one. And that's when they stuck it back in my, I had a bag.
Wow. That's, man, was that.
Now, here's what happened.
Yeah.
Here's what happened. Before it was all over, I didn't know that I had it back in my bag yet. And it was Vesiana. That was the Vesiana thing. I broke that story big time. And there's some people don't know about it. That's their tough luck. Anyway, so I was doing that, and so when it was done, this guy comes up to, you know, people run to the front to ask questions and stuff. And so this guy, he was dressed, he looked like he was middle-aged, but not you know, not too old. Looked like he'd be about in his 50s, no more than 60. And he had not a tie, but a nice jacket on and slacks and everything. And he walked up to me, and he said, John, it's okay. Everything's okay. They just want to know what you know. And he kept saying that. And that it wasn't computing in my head. I had no idea what the hell is this guy talking to me about. Who wants to know? And what do they want to know about what I'm doing, you know?
Wow.
And that's what he was saying. He was trying to tell me that. I've discovered now that some of the old guys in the CIA, and most of them are dead now, but over the years, they liked me. A lot of them were not even in on any of this stuff because it's need to know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's their, my CIA, holy shit, look at the bad stuff we're doing and all that kind of thing. And so it's the new people that are CIA now. They don't need, they have nothing to do with it, but all this stuff is declassified and they don't want me to talk about it.
Tough. We got this thing called the First Amendment. We're going to use it.
That's what happened that day when they took that away from me because they thought they were going to, you know, find out a lot of stuff. And the problem was that it was locked. They couldn't get in. And he tried to comfort me that he didn't say it's back in your satchel there, but he said, it's okay. You're okay. You're okay.
Wow. A man in the arena. There you go. All right. So back to Mexico City. Oswald, we know why he went to the Soviet Union, And this is sort of the question I keep asking. Well, why did he go to Mexico City and who sent him? Which is kind of another way of saying, you know, who's involved in the plot effectively. Those are similar questions. And this kind of gets into the, you know, CIA station in Mexico City is asking John Witten for information about Oswald. When they do that, Witten says, oh yeah, the last thing that we, you know, says here in his file, the last thing that we know about him is that he was in the Soviet Union in 1962.
This here is what Witten said, because he didn't know any better. Latest headquarters information, the State Department report dated May 62. Well, you know, in October of 1963, as far as he knows, Oswald's still over there in the Soviet Union. Now, how is that possible with all the stuff this guy did in New Orleans, for example, all that stuff, but it's all been suppressed. Here are what this is the route on the record. You know what? This is on top of a big report by J. Edgar Hoover that he's thrown into the front door of the CIA. And so that's what he's trying to do, because Hoover is he hates not knowing stuff, you know, and nobody ever makes a mistake in the FBI that Hoover was there. And so that's what's going on here. And so where is the stuff? Well, here's where it is. It's not this one here, 20128-9248. That is his. But when you look at the 201 numbers on these two things here, they're it's completely different set of numbers that has nothing to do with, except for it's in the SAS. This is the Security Affairs Staff, which is a you shouldn't call it that. It's their Cuban thing. And it's big. They got a big Cuban thing down in Florida. And so it's the SAS. And we're talking about just a couple of people at the top of the SAS are even aware of this. So they hide it. They hide all these things that Hoover's throwing in. They get rid of it and stick it in the FBCC file. And that's it. It's gone. Nobody has it. Now, somehow they get it back in the... In the triple combination safes around the time of the assassination, so that when the shots ring out in Dealey Plaza and people start running around, Bagley was included, all of a sudden they could see the stuff that they missed. And that was terrible. You know, how the hell could we all miss this? And it was a way of getting the CIA to do whatever they were told. And same thing with FBI. They were shredding documents.
And I'll come to the FBI here in just a second, but on the CIA side, so you and Jefferson Morley noticed, you tell me about the exact story, but you guys noticed that Jane Roman, this woman at the CIA, had signed off on Witten's statement being true, basically that you know, all they had was information up to 62.
It wasn't like exactly like that. So you just, well, let me tell the story.
Yeah,
I knew about her. She was the liaison officer for the CIA, and I knew that she. Because I got these documents, and I knew that she had seen the real story, and so I told Jefferson Morley about it, and he looked up. He was working for the Washington Post at the time. He got the address real quick. It was on Rock Creek Parkway, so we went in there together, but he didn't say anything. I did all the so I took her through each one of these. We read it together. Do you remember this one here? And yeah, I remember it. Oh, okay, that's pretty interesting. How about these people? Yeah, I know who they are. This is me, Jane Roman, right here, and this is Will Pataki, and so on. And so then I took her to the next one, and we went through that one. And do you remember that one? Oh yeah, of course. I said, well, how about this one from Witten? You signed off on that one too. And all of a sudden, her lips went back up towards her ears. And she was, you know, she said, okay, But I wasn't involved in any hanky panking. She told me, and so that's how it happened. There's more I could tell you, but that's enough. And so when we walked out of there, you know, he asked me the question. He said, you know, what just happened in there? And it was, you know, it was a clever way I got her to say, and she got in so much trouble because we reported it. It was out all over the place. And I don't know what they told her, but I mean, they didn't, nobody killed her, but boy, she got in real trouble for fessing up to that.
So, and what she actually, you asked her, you know, the significance of, you know, after she gave you that smile, and then she said, yes, I'm signing off on something I know isn't true. And then you guys asked her, yeah, go ahead.
You're signing off on it because it is obviously a keen.
And she said, well, to me, it's indicative of a keen interest in Oswald held very closely on a need to know basis.
Exactly. And that's what really got her in such hot water. Because up to that time, and even afterwards, the CIA said they never were interested at all in Oswald. And that was a bunch of bunk. Because, you know, a lot of people worked on the Oswald case in different places in the CIA and elsewhere, in FBI and so on. So, yeah, that was a complete blow up of what had been a lie that they got away with for years and years and years. And Jane Roman just, you know, when I caught her like that, flat-footed, she just admitted it. And I said to her, you know, it's okay because it's after, you know, it's all over. And now we have the records review board and they're the only ones who can decide. And so she thought it was good. We could talk about it now.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be. To be.
Yeah.
He didn't like it in the CIA. The big guys didn't like it at all. Mm-mm.
Yeah, because people try to say that Oswald wasn't an affiliate. Let me ask you this question. Have you had any folks argue against you on the Popov's Mole story of Oswald being a witting false defector? I mean, have you had people try to give you pushback? Like, what's their counterpoint? Is there counter argument?
Not on that part, but on Sully.
Okay.
So my good friend Jeff Morley was the only guy that he said, no, I don't believe that, but I haven't read the book. see okay. Jeff always did stuff. He would take a position that would help him. You know, people would want to talk to him and film him and all that kind of stuff. I didn't care about that. He did. So he would say he would take a position knowing that it's not true.
Mm. All right. So CIA, Oswald's not on their radar because you've got the bifurcated file with the stuff at 1963 and after going into the SAS file, like you were talking about. Let's turn to the FBI and this Marvin Giesling guy, who this is huge story.
Because, you know, the CIA completely, this main stops people from knowing, except for just a few people, and they're not supposed to talk about it because they're not the ones who are really in on this, but they are not responsible. All they've done is to make sure that there's nothing in the CIA that's going to be talked about before the shots ring out in Dealey Plaza. They have muted his threat level to a point where nobody's even thinking about it except for the people who did this, that were asked to. On the other side is this guy Gisling, because he knows. See, Witten doesn't. Witten didn't lie. The files lied to him. Mm-hmm. Now, we get over to the FBI, and you got a guy that his name is Marvin Gisling. He was the one in the FBI that did the whole thing with Oswald when he went over there. He knew everything about Oswald. So he's the one who has to do the same thing. And somebody told him to. And for him to do that, he knows. He's not like Witten. He has to take a deep swallow before he writes that thing. It's another, I guess I don't have it here.
The cancellation exactly. of the flash. Yeah.
And look at the date. It's the same. It's exactly the same date as if they're doing it with the CIA. Now, that's important for a couple of reasons. Number one, because you know he knows. And he's always known about Oswald. And he was put him in the espionage thing. And nobody could go in there and touch anything without talking to Gisling. It was him. So now he's coming out and he's doing this. He's fessing. He's actually saying the guy's fine. They took him out of the espionage thing and he's on the parade route now, and they don't do anything about it. That's why it's so important that the FBI does this, because the FBI is responsible for looking into anybody who's on a parade route and take them off if there's any question about them.
So if Gisling had not taken that action, then the FBI would have been aware of
that whole idea. Wouldn't have worked well with Oswald up there shooting.
They would have taken him off of the route just because of his
travels. It wouldn't have even pulled him up there if they hadn't been able to do that. And right. I don't even know if he was up there. You know, it doesn't matter. He can be there, just like, you know, when we go back to Mexico City, Oswald went to Cuba, but he didn't.
Yes.
We have things that show us that he went to Cuba. And I told you, you know, the
letters.
Yeah, the letters are just one thing. It's just part of it. So there, it was all set and it got ruined because, you know, when you do it, sometimes it's not a good idea when you have a plan to have parts of a plan that if it goes wrong is going to hit you in the face afterwards. You know, that can happen. And that happened to Oswald's people that were there doing this stuff in Mexico City. It did not work out very well.
And Gisling was never interviewed. I understand he was disciplined in some way by Hoover, but he was never interviewed.
Including him. Everybody was. Hoover, he sent them all out into the pasture. Most of them, they had to go do the motorcycle thing in Oklahoma or something. They lost their jobs. And he disciplined them twice. You're not allowed to do that according to the rules of civil whatever. And he didn't care. He was so pissed off at what had happened. His FBI, you know, mm-hmm. didn't stop the guy, the shooter. He just couldn't. He couldn't believe that. And for every time you see these things like this, no matter what it is, you see his terrible handwriting. Okay, but you know, it's just as bad as this and that. In other words, he never forgave them for this. Uh-huh. He's always writing or are the top of everything. Oh. And you can see that. And he's just so pissed off that they didn't tell him what they were up to.
Is there someone who's a Warren Report defender, is there a counter argument that exists for why Gisling could have done this? Like what, I don't understand, because it feels like a smoking gun. He's never asked about it, but I mean, what is there an argument for negligence?
There is, of course, but the thing is, what they need to do is kill the president. All right. Now, once that happens, the way they do it, you have to understand now that this is the next part of the story. What does it look like? Well, depends on who you are. If you're public, you think Oswald was a lone nut. He did it all by himself. If you work in any place like the FBI or the CIA, you know what you think? Holy shit! They were working for the Castro and the KGB, and we knew all about it. We had all these files and everything, and we didn't notice it. So, and that she holds up to today. And my boss, in the National Security Agency, one night, he called me up on the phone. And he said, look, you know, because he knew what I was doing. He knew I was researching this stuff the whole time. He said, yeah, it was Castro and the KGB. It's right here. And he showed me the fucking papers. And of course it is. That's how you get the guys at that top of everything to believe that that's what happened. So you have two sets of what happened. And one was for public consumption, and the other one was to actually scare the piss out of people. And you know, when you see what happened, they were, nobody cared to actually do a real investigation. And there was only one guy they needed to do something with, and that's where Lyndon Baines Johnson came in and did exactly what they needed to do, which was to tell this poor guy, Earl Warren, who's the Chief Justice of the United States of America, who should not be doing anything like this. And so they tell him, if you don't do it, it's going to, you know, what's going to happen? It's going to be 40 million dead Americans. And so Earl Warren said so on WGBH in Washington, D.C. He told about it. On the air, and he said he resisted it, and once he said when LBJ told him that, he said, well, I guess if bad, I better take the job. So he actually told us that story that happened to him. Earl Warren himself said why he took the job.
We have
WGTH, by the way.
But okay, gotcha. So on that topic, the day after the assassination, there's a call from Hoover to LBJ. Yep. And we'd lost the audio of it, and there's 14 minutes missing of it, but 14 minutes missing from the transcript. We don't have the transcript for that part either. But the part that we do have the transcript for, LBJ asked Hoover, well, what about the Mexico City angle? And then Hoover says, well, yeah, Oswald's going around to the Cuban embassy and the Soviet embassy. But it appears it's not Oswald. It's another person down there. There's an imposter. So then after hearing this from Hoover, LBJ and the recorded calls we have, you just talked about Earl Warren, who verified this independently. But we also have LBJ talking to Richard Russell, where he's describing.
You hear the ice clinking in his drink. You know, he's drinking. Yeah. He says, you know, Bobby turned him down, man. I got it to happen. He was all happy with himself.
LBJ, that knowing that, you know, Hoover just told him that two things: Oswald's connected with the Soviets, and also it's not really Oswald; it's an imposter. But LBJ doesn't say the imposter part to Richard Russell. No,
he
doesn't.
He knows a little more, than the others do. You see, because that guy is not the imposter. He's just a guy that walked in and out. And when you look very, very carefully at the paper trail on this, when the first time that they talked about this guy, they didn't say he was anything. They just said, we saw on the camera, we saw this guy go in. They did not say that he was part of anything. Well, by the time you get it back to the United States, they turn it around and say it was thus and such. And so it never was anything. There's other people that go in and out of these places. It's not just like one guy, you know, for 6 weeks, and then some 6 weeks later, one other person. There's people who are walking in and out of that Cuban consulate, both of them actually, all the time.
So do you think that LBJ not telling Richard Russell the part about the imposter was because he didn't want to, you know, bury the headline that he wanted to pass on to Russell, which is 40 million dead Americans, if he didn't, you know, serve his country?
Russell didn't want to do it, by the way. Russell didn't
do it. Right.
You know, they didn't, he wasn't really going to tell him everything. But, I remember as dumb as you are. He says, as you are, you got to do this for me. And if you don't do it, I forget what it was. He really, you know, laid it on the line. And so Russell went along with it, but he didn't like it. He didn't want to have any part of it.
But did LBJ not say the imposter part to Russell because he had found out subsequently that that part wasn't true, or because he just didn't want to parade of the other story?
Part is what was spoken on those tapes. That was really what it was. It wasn't the picture, which had nothing to do with anything, but all those tapes, yes, were exactly red hot. And that's really what was at stake, because that's the imposter was not going in and out. If that guy was filmed, it would have ruined everything. I'm talking about the guy who was the imposter, not the guy who walked in there to see he was a seaman, you know. He had nothing to do with it.
So did LBJ know that what he was saying to Richard Russell wasn't true, and what he said to Earl Warren wasn't true? I guess that's my question.
Yeah, he fooled Earl Warren, and he was bragging about it. He said that Bobby tried 2-3 times, and he didn't. He couldn't do it.
But he told the same lie to Richard Russell.
Not Earl Warren. I mean, Russell knew that it wasn't true.
Okay.
And he and LBJ just, like, I don't know, maybe he had some power over Russell, because he sure told him, treated him like a kid, and told him, stupid, as dumb as you are, you're going to do exactly what I tell you to do, you know?
Yeah, he wasn't super nice. I saw, you see the picture of him talking to Russell. It's not at this instance, but another time when he's got his, like, nose in his face in the Oval Office. You know, just one thing to mention that you mentioned to me is, we can't look at Mexico City in a vacuum. And we got to keep in mind there's all these other things happening at the same time. Any comments on the other things that are happening simultaneously? Yeah, because,
you know, you have a lot of things that have to happen. About 6 have to happen along the way. And some of them take more time than others. So, for example, the whole idea of gutting JFK's withdrawal plan was one of them. And that was something they decided on in the summer of 1963, because by that time Kennedy had an idea that they're going to kill him, because he kept saying no.
So you're talking about the withdrawal was from Vietnam. Kennedy's plans were being gutted.
That took some time to do. So it's not like just Oswald goes over there for 3 weeks or 1 week and that thing's done. This was the main thing. There's two things that had to happen. Number one was to gut Kennedy's withdrawal plan. Number two, to replace it with our plan 34A, which is full scale intervention. Those two things were happening simultaneously. And Taylor, who is now chief of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was the one doing that. He did not tell McNamara, the defense minister, the secretary of defense. And so that's what happened there. He did it behind McNamara's back, and therefore McNamara was the guy talking to Kennedy, and it was behind Kennedy's back. Of course it was, but that's only half of the pie. The other half is a guy by the name of Krulak, a Marine who put together Op Plan 34A at the very early part of summer. Could have been, it's right around June. There's one of those SETF conferences, and and that's what it is. It's Op Plan 34A opens the door to everything. And so very soon afterwards, not like a few days, but within a few weeks, there was some talk going around about it. And so, the State Department wanted to know about that, and they were told, no, that's not true. None of that. And so State Department made this comment. There's no such thing. It doesn't exist. Yeah, no shit, Sherlock. Of course it doesn't exist, because it's not going to become real until 2 days before Kennedy is murdered. That is, Op Plan 34A is the opposite of gutting Kennedy's withdrawal plan. That's how they did it. Now, it took a long time to do that, and they had to be very careful how to do that, because if you do the wrong thing, and people get ahead of the game. But I guess it's easier than I would like to think, because there was nobody who was going to say no. But there are times when a hierarchy was overturned by a military hierarchy, and when you do that, sometimes it's failed. We have examples of where it fails. If one person knows beforehand, that's it, and all of a sudden everybody gets arrested, put in jail, and killed. So you need a military that is completely on board, which they were, mm-hmm. and that's how they were able to do this. And so and Kennedy, that's why Kennedy knew he should have got rid of the CIA and the military guys. It was his prerogative, but he was scared of them. Mm. And he thought if he just left them alone, he could do his thing, which was the economy and all those great things that he did for us. But anyway, that's a hell of a story. That's what was going on there. Those are the two big things, big picture things that mm-hmm. had to happen in order to get Kennedy out of the way.
Right. Well, I really appreciate your time, Dr. Newman. And again, thank you for your scholarship and your work on this through the years. And I look forward to reading the books of yours I haven't read yet and the ones that are yet to come out.
Well, just tell me when you find a mistake and I'll correct it.
Well, to your credit, and I just really briefly here, you know, I believe you had said that you had thought Angleton was behind it, Oswald, but then you learned that sort of Angleton had been duped by all of the Soviet moles, and he wasn't necessarily the brightest guy. And that's you corrected what you had previously said and got a little pushback from that.
His father was there at the same time. His father, where I was born in Dayton, Ohio. Anyway, so his business set up a big piece over in Italy. And his father was also in the OSS at the time. So his father had double duty. And while that was happening, his son was growing up and doing poetry and stuff like that, you know?
Right.
And so his dad set him up to take over his place. And it wasn't very good, because he just didn't matter who he talked to. He didn't care who they were. That was all information as far as he was concerned. And so that's okay for a while, but when you're taking stuff from the wrong people and it's not true, it doesn't work too well. And so by the time he got to London with Philby, that's where it was over. He was believing everything that Philby said, and everything that he knew, he led Philby to know about. And so, yeah, he, from the very get-go, he was a little boy still and needed a daddy. And he told him what he wanted to hear. He was fine waiting for years after years after years to find that mole in the Soviet Russia division, and it was never there.
Wow. Yeah, never there. Surprise, surprise. Well, again, thank you, Dr. Newman. Appreciate your time, and we'll look forward to talking to you again in the future. Maybe I'll see you at a conference or something somewhere.
Yep, could be.
Next time on Solving JFK, we'll be doing recap and rebuttals on episodes 56 through 59 with JFK assassination researcher, author, and expert Larry Hancock.
How do you feel when you switch to GEICO and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, "Happy Friday!" Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with GEICO feels just like that. Get more with GEICO.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be.